allows us to maintain this homomorphism while symmetric. In two dimensions, I provide the condition like that. What does it mean? In two dimensions, has some two-dimensional worksheet with some boundary. Well, okay, let me read it straight. Doesn't matter. And I can pick coordinates parallel and perpendicular to the boundary. And then the component parallel, perpendicular, for the stress tensor should vanish. Now that this can be interpreted as the energy flux coming out of the boundary. So this telling you this boundary does not produce energy or absorb energy. Now, suppose I'm given a theory of a scalar field. So a free massless scalar field, say. Massive too, doesn't matter. So how would I make sure that this condition holds? So this component of the stress tensor is essentially this. So an actual way to make sure that this holds is that is to either make sure that the derivative of the scalar field along the boundary vanishes, or that the derivative perpendicular to the boundary vanishes. These two conditions are usually denoted as Norman or Dirichlet boundary conditions. You surely encounter them in when you're studying electromagnetism. So Neumann boundary conditions set to zero the perpendicular component of the first derivative of the scalar field. This is pretty much the boundary condition which emerges naturally if you do some variational problem. Because if you're given some action, on the manifold with boundary, you want to make sure that this is stationary. If you let your field vary freely, including in the manifold and at the boundary, they'll try to make sure that this is zero. You integrate it by parts. To get the equations of motion, but there is a boundary term. So if your variations are free, your variations scalar fields are free, say in your path integral, you get Norman boundary conditions naturally. Unless you add some extra terms to the action, we just leave it the boundary. We'll do so at the end of the lecture, but for now, this is it. On the other hand, the other possibility, which is Dirichlet boundary conditions, is to set the scalar field to be some constant at the boundary. This also kills the boundary term because it's just killing by hand the fluctuation of the field at the boundary. So my path integral will be a path integral over all values of all the configurations of the field which go to a constant at the boundary. So these are Dirichlet boundary conditions. And of course, this implies that the derivative along the boundary of x is zero. So both these boundary conditions classically satisfy this constraint. And actually satisfies quantum mechanically too. Nothing goes wrong quantum mechanically.
With the Neumann boundary condition, is it necessarily that it goes to zero? Because I'm thinking in the case of electromagnetism where if you want to use Neumann boundary conditions, you cannot impose that the boundary vanishes. Because if there's,
So if there is something else living at the boundary, right. This will change. For example, if I had an extra field that lives at the boundary, there will be some coupling of x to some operator.
Okay.
Made out of the boundary fields. And then the variation will bring this operator here on the right-hand side. So indeed, in the electromagnetism, you get something like the current here.
Yeah.
Another possibility is if I add something like x squared to the boundary, then this will give me derivative of x proportional to x. It's called the mixed boundary condition. It's useful for some purposes, but it typically breaks conformal invariance, scale invariance. So, right, so what boundary conditions are okay? What boundary conditions can be used to define a simple brain, simple deep brain? I thought, strictly speaking, the name deep brain came about when people realized that instead of doing this on all the directional space time, they could actually do this too. So Dirichlet brain. I think that was the origin of the name. But if I define a deep brain just as something that pokes holes, puts boundaries in my worksheets, the natural way to define a deep brain is to pick Neumann on some directions, Dirichlet on some other directions. So if I want to define, say, a DP brain, I would take non-boundary conditions for the coordinates from x0 all the way to xd, and Dirichlet for the remaining coordinates. So this gives me an object which, roughly speaking, you know, constrains the endpoints of my strings to live at some fixed location in these directions and to move freely in these directions.
You mean P, not D?
Yes, thank you. So roughly speaking, the endpoints of my strings will be attached to some P plus one dimensional object. Now, of course, you can always act on this with some Lorentz transformation. This will give you some generalization of this, where some linear combination of the scalar fields have Neumann, some other linear combination has Dirichlet. But you see, if you look at the stress tensor, we put the Lorentz indices. The basic condition is roughly that the directions which are Dirichlet are orthogonal to the directions which are Neumann. So my neighboring rule is defined as a sort of orthogonal splitting of space-time. The directions which are along the brain and the directions which are orthogonal to the brain. Now, I've been stressing out before that the string theory has no continuous parameters. This looks like a continuous parameter, the position of the D-brain. But as we'll see momentarily, it actually is a dynamical object, a dynamical field. But when you start, your D-brain is just an infinitely heavy, rigid plane stretching across space-time. Now, perturbatively, when you start working perturbation theory, you will see that this D-brain actually is not infinitely heavy. It has a mass or a tension of order 1 over G string. Okay. So this actually follows from the fact that it is a source of order G string for the graviton. And the gravitational coupling is G string squared. Okay. Okay. So now there are some boundary conditions. There are two sort of questions which we might want to answer. The first one is, if I use this D-brain, I put it in space-time, which sort of closed string strings is going to serve? So if I have my string diagram, I should just have it etched on the blackboard. And I add boundary to the worksheet, sources, closed strings. Which closed string does it source? To study this problem, what you want is to study a cylinder geometry. With the boundary placed at some moment in tau. This problem will tell you which sources. The other question you can ask is to study the theory on a strip. On a ribbon. With some boundary conditions here. Here I have just one source of boundary condition. Here I can have two sources of boundary conditions, different ones, at the two endpoints. This will tell me which sort of open strings are there in the system if I add D brains, D1 and D2. So, in a sense, so I start with this one because it's a little bit easier in the sense that you already know what is the theory on a cylinder. You know what are the states of a theory in a cylinder. So we need to try to figure out is which states are created by putting a boundary at the origin of Euclidean time. So remember that the free scalar has an expansion of this sort. So suppose I want to put normal boundary conditions for the scalar field at tau equal to 0. It means I want the tau derivative of x to vanish at tau equal to 0. That sort of creates. So the state created by this boundary must satisfy the property that a n minus a bar minus n kills it. And also p on the state is 0. It's just I'm just Fourier expanding the condition d tau x equal to 0 at tau equal to 0. So how do we solve these constraints? Well, first of all, to solve this one, we built our state out of the vacuum. And to satisfy this constraint, we just need something like that. Okay. So this is the state which is created by a normal boundary condition. So it's a state which has no momentum, and it contains all sorts of oscillators. So that means that the closed strings created by a D-brain have no momentum in the directions along the D-brain. That makes sense. If a source is uniform and extended along some direction, it will not source fields which have momentum in that direction. And the other observation is that it will source all closed string states, roughly the same intensity. So it's a, the deep brain is a source for the tachyon, the graviton, the B, but also for whatever higher excited states of the of string theory. On the other hand, if I do the Dirichlet boundary conditions, I only get the condition that An plus A bar minus N kills the state. So, of course, I also need to impose that X acting on the state is X naught. So I'm trying to impose that X at tau equal to 0 equal to X naught. So again, if we re-expand this constraint, and I get this. So again, it's relatively simple to solve these constraints. By the way, this sort of constraints you might have encountered when you're studying the harmonic oscillator, for example, or quantization. They sort of had to do it. I mean, they are, well, okay, there's not much to say. They are interesting. They're not coherent states, right? They're not exponentials of one oscillator. There's something called squeeze state, I guess, exponentials of bilinears. But the coefficient here is such as it's actually delta, roughly it's a delta function. The state. It's just a Fourier transform of delta function for the derivative of X. And here I get a Fourier transform of a delta function for the zero mode. So this is the sort of state which is created by Dirichlet boundary condition. So again, I'm going to create all sorts of oscillators for the strings. I'm going to create closed string states with every sort of excitations. But crucially, these Dirichlet boundary conditions create sources fields with every sort of momentum. Again, this makes sense if it's something localized. It sources all momenta uniformly with a profile e to the ip x naught. So this is really the Fourier transform of a delta function. This D brain at the leading order in perturbation theory, it's an infinitely thin object sitting at x naught and sourcing all sort of closed strings. So the picture is really that this endpoint of the watch chip literally ends on some plane in space-time. Also, this sort of should tell you that, well, okay. So it should be clear that if the D brains are infinitely heavy, this might be okay. You know, you're generating a state with momentum, but you're infinitely heavy, you can recoil infinitesimally, and it's okay. If these D brains have finite mass, then they will have to recoil in a process like that. Because the mass is of order 1 over G string, the recoil is sort of perturbative in size and appears in higher order in perturbation theory. It's actually very similar to an infrared effect in quantum field theory. It's actually pretty messy to account for properly, but doable.
You're saying p plus one directions would have the Neumann boundary conditions,
yes,
and the rest would have the Dirichlet. So now you've written for one scalar,
yes,
it could be Neumann or Dirichlet. Mm-hmm. So when we have more, I mean, what is the total state, the one that?
Okay, that sorry, yes. So what is the state for the p plane? I want to integrate over the transverse directions. Transverse momentum, e to the I, the transverse, not x, not the position of the plane, mm-hmm, in the transverse direction. So using transverse poly is not a terribly good idea because I use it for the worksheet. It's meant in space time. I hope this is clear. Just leave them. And then you get these sort of exponentials. Actually, guys, might be worth to explore this a little bit further. So which sort of states are there hidden in this object? So surely we saw some tachyon. That's true and that's boring. The D-brain is a point, like it's a localized source for the tachyon. But the next thing we source is actually a graviton. And then the next object is a graviton. So, see, we are sourcing one of the massless fields in our string spectrum. The indices are symmetric, so I'm not sourcing any B field. I'm sourcing graviton and dilaton.
Sorry, is there also making some kind of summation over the indices?
Sorry? Yeah, there is.
No, and the line above them is the subscript ins.
Yes.
Are we starting
yes.
over those?
That's right. They should put things out of there. So this D branch source the graviton and source the dilaton. Some kinds of brains will make the dilaton become very small near the brain. So perturbation theory is better and better as you approach the brain. Some other brains make the dilaton bigger and bigger as you approach them, which means the perturbation theory is actually worse and worse to describe their neighborhood. And they distort the graviton. So they distort the graviton like a I mean, if you're trying to try to write down this coupling to the graviton as a stress tensor of some dynamical object, this is really the stress tensor you would associate with a brain, something that looks like that. So you get something like a, you know, an energy density in the directions along the object. Sorry, I want to do this properly. Maybe I'll wait. Yeah, I'll wait to that later in the lecture to explain what the physical meaning of this opposite sign or the components along the brain and the components perpendicular to the brain. For now, let's just study open strings for a bit. The simplest thing to look at is to ask which open strings live attached to a non-membrane. Yes?
What happens if you put, so since these are source for gravitons, if you put the background of gravitons, I mean, in space time, you have curvature, then what happens to the condition for the deep brain? I mean, there is nothing, is there a way to describe a covariant in a covariant way, the Dirichlet conditions?
Yeah, so there is an action. We'll hopefully get to the end of to the end of the lecture. There is an action for the deep brain, which tells you a leading order in alpha prime, leading order in the curvature, which shape the deep brain would like to take in a gravitational field. So which open strings can live attached to a non-membrane? So you need to study the Skylar field on a strip with non-membrane conditions, sigma equal to 0 and sigma equal to pi. So it's not very difficult to write down the Fourier expansion of a scalar field with this boundary condition. I'll write it like that. So here we're doing open strings. Now, if you compare this Fourier expansion with the Fourier expansion on the cylinder, you notice two differences. First of all, we essentially identified A's and A bars. A way to understand that is that non-membrane conditions, which now are the sigma x equal to 0, can be written in holomorphic coordinates as dSxi. You see, I think I defined it that S was tau minus I sigma, if I remember correctly. So the sigma derivative looks like this. So in non-membrane conditions, sort of tie together the holomorphic and anti-holomorphic parts of X. That's ultimately the reason for which we ended up identifying AN and A bars. Another small difference is the normalization of the momentum. So in order for the momentum to be still permanently conjugate to the zero mode, I need to change the normalization slightly. A way to understand that is that P is supposed to be the zero mode. It's the momentum associated to, is a conserved current, is conserved charge associated to the translations, to shifts of the scalar field. So it can be written as the integral over your space, over space of the current, the tau x. So here we are integrating the tau x from 0 to 2 pi. Here I'm integrating it from 0 to pi. So to get the same normalization of p, I need an extra factor of 2. And now, everything is pretty much identical to what we did at for closed strings, actually simpler. because I only have one set of oscillators and not two set of oscillators. So the Hilbert space of open strings will have a bunch of momentum eigenstates here by the negative, by the positive A's, and I will build on them with the negative A's.
Sourcing. Mm-hmm.
So yes.
How can you have a brain sourcing such a thing?
Take this picture and cut it. And what follow the worksheet? It's not easy to visualize, but you see, it starts on the V-brain, it goes around and comes back to the V-brain. If you try to take a picture of this at a fixed time slice, you actually have a propagation on the geometry like this.
But doesn't that only give you boundary conditions on one end of the other?
No, on both. See. If you, well, let me just perform this picture. Well, okay, just follow a path for an open string. I mean, open string is two ends. So it's going to start from here, it's going to go around the picture, and come back here. Now, if I have multiple brains, I could have open string which have one choice of brain here and a different choice of brain here. And I'll do that momentarily. So what could the spectrum of physical states be? You already essentially did the calculation before, because to study the closed string, we're looking at one set of oscillators and then the other set and putting the results together. So here the physical states are gonna be tachyon, except that because of this difference in normalization, p squared is now 1/2 instead of 2. And then I have some massless object. Yeah, perhaps I should say that the Casimir energy here is still -1. So the conditions for a physical state are still that L0 equal to -1, equal to 1, and L and kill it. And positive. The only difference is that L0 is now 2p squared plus the number of oscillators acted upon. And the null state, so there is this condition, and also there is a condition that epsilon mu p mu is 0. And the null states are the ones where epsilon mu is multiple of p mu. Okay, these conditions will seem very, very familiar. This is just a gauge field. So whenever you have normal boundary conditions in a brain, you have gauge fields. So there are gauge fields whose polarization points along your brain. So if you put normal boundary conditions in all your directions space-time, you have a brain which is just filling space-time. And this brain supports open strings, which include a tachyon and a gauge field. Now, if I take multiple copies of the same brain, then I get a matrix of open string fields, because I can pick any copy of the brain I want here and here. And as a result, my open strings will be matrices. I get gauge fields, value matrices, which are non-abelian gauge fields. So the emergence of non-abelian gauge theories on brains was one of the main reasons people got so excited about brains at the very beginning. So it's fun. We are encountering one by one all things that are fun in theoretical physics. We got a graviton from closed strings. Now we got a gauge field from open strings. Now, if you want to know what happens to events which are not space filling, we need to look at Dirichlet boundary conditions. So for some of the scalar fields in the brain, I have Dirichlet boundary conditions. So suppose for now I'm studying the open strings, the stretch between the brain and itself. So both boundary conditions set X to some X naught at the boundary.
Saying this is going to give rise to non-Abelian gauge fields.
Yes.
Where does the non-Abelian index go?
So suppose you have multiple copies of a. What does it mean to have multiple copies of a brain? Now this is something. So we introduced in string theory. It actually makes sense in quantum field theory too. So you can have boundary conditions which are a direct sum of some other boundary conditions. And what that means is that the Hilbert space on the strip is actually a direct sum of the Hilbert spaces between boundary condition I and boundary condition J. Now, if your boundary conditions are all the same, so if you have n copies of the same boundary condition, that becomes the tensor product between the Hilbert space between boundary condition itself and C to the n squared. So there are n squared copies of your vacuum, n squared copies of the first state, and so on. So the way to think about it is that your ground states are labeled by the momentum and which of the brains you have on the left and which of the brains you have on the right. So they are matrices. Now, what's not trivial is that the actual scattering of these open strings is going to give you the same constraints as in the non-Abelian gauge theory. But in a sense, it's forced on you by the fact that quantum field theory, the string theory reproduces quantum field theory at low energy. And there is a theorem in quantum field theory that whenever you have this sort of situation, you have a gauge theory based on some legal. So if you have Dirichlet boundary condition, you lose your momentum. So open strings which are attached to a D-brain cannot move away from the D-brain. Perhaps not surprising. But you still have the oscillators. So if I have some DP-brain, maybe I should call it D. I don't confuse it. Momentum P. If I put together information about all the scalar fields, my ground states will be labeled by momentum, which has only components in the normal boundary conditions, along the normal directions. I'll have a tachyon, and I'll have some masses, the states. And now it's useful to separate the directions along the brain and direction perpendicular to the brain. So this gives me still a gauge field. gauge field, but which lives on the brain, literally. So in particular, has components only along the brain. So see, your gauge symmetry only involves components along the brain. And then there are a bunch of extra fields which have the index of space-time, which is perpendicular to the brain. And these are just the position, the fluctuations in the position. So the massless modes or the open strings on the brain include this funny gauge field, for which I cannot, I mean, I don't have a good intuitive reason to say why there should be a gauge field on the liver. But they also include some fields which describe these fluctuations of the brain. So this shows you that, as I mentioned, that parameter over there is not a continuous parameter, it's really the VEV of a scalar field, the VEV of a degree of freedom. Now, and if you want the fact that, so the fact that if you have, actually, let me use this guy over here. Sorry. So now suppose that you have several DP brains which are coincident. Okay. So all the fields, all the open strings that live on these brains are matrices. Just because, you know, an open string can start from one brain and then on the other. Now, that the gauge fields are matrices seems intuitive physically. Okay, intuitive. I mean, again, difficult to understand perhaps, but not so strange. I have a gauge field, it's an abelian. I didn't know where the gauge fields came from. I don't know where these abelian gauge fields come from, but it's fine. But the positions become matrices, perhaps, is what's most striking. So we have several n coincident D brains, somehow the fluctuations of these D brains away from each other are described by matrices instead of by N fields. It's a very peculiar and interesting feature. Again, it's another hint that geometry really doesn't work the same way at short distances for string theory as it works for quantum field theory. In quantum field theory, this would be surprising. But maybe not completely surprising. In a sense, if I have a quantum field theory, I have a bunch of solitons, and I bring them together, it's possible the new degrees of freedom actually appear when the solitons come together. So perhaps it's not completely shocking. Now, when the d-brains are separated, at some large distance, we would expect our normal, sane geometric intuition to hold. So if I have two d-brains which are separated by a vast distance, I don't expect strange string theory effects to happen. Now, indeed, if you study an open string stretched between two d-brains like that, you write your Fourier expansion of the field, you find an extra crucial term, which allows x to go from x naught to x1 as you transverse across the strip. that essentially modifies the energy of your state. It's like a contribution to your a naught or a naught bar. So that this, so that now the mass of particles is shifted by xEO times x1 squared over 8 pi squared. So for example, if the strings are, as long as the brain gets separated, the massless modes are not massless anymore. They become massive. So in particular, this funny off-diagonal components of the position become very massive and negligible. Even the tachyon stops being a tachyon if the separation is sufficiently large. I should perhaps mention that the open string tachyon is much less troublesome than the closed string tachyon. So the closed string tachyon represents an instability which we fully do not understand. We don't know what happens to bosonic string theory if the tachyon follows, if the closed string tachyon falls down from its potential. On the other hand, if the open string tachyon falls down its potential, and you sort of ignore the closed string tachyon, all that happens is the Dibrin actually disappears. So the open string tachyon really just represents the fact that the Dibrins are unstable solitons in bosonic string. In superstring, some Dibrins will be stable and have no tachyon. Some others will be unstable and have a tachyon. Okay, so the short version of this is that right, so Dibrins support fluctuation modes, they support the gauge field. When they're well separated, there are some extra very massive degrees of freedom which have to do with open string stretched across through the two brains. When they get close, something fancier happens. Get extra massless states, extra light states, which really reinterpret the geometry. And this is a bit, this should resemble the things that I said about T-duality. There are very nice interplays between Dibrins and T-duality. In the sense that you can take your theory on a circle, put some Dibrins in, make the circle small, do a T-duality to describe the theory in terms of a dual big circle, and ask which Dibrins are there in the new theory. It just turns out that T-duality exchanges Neumann in Dirichlet boundary conditions. So if you start from a space-filling brain, you do a T-duality, you end up with a brain localized at some position in space. And usually in textbooks, that's how Dibrins are, Dirichlet boundary conditions are introduced. So in textbooks like Boczynski, they will first introduce for you Neumann boundary conditions, space-filling brains, and open string modes that just propagate everywhere in space-time. And then they'll do a T-duality and discover the localized brains. Now, last thing we can do about Dibrins. So here we saw some infinitesimal fluctuations, something like the gravitons we saw in the closed strings. But for the gravitons, we also saw that we can get an effective action. We can really find gravity by studying the motion of strings in some background and requiring this to be a consistent problem. So in a similar way, what we can do is to explore more intricate boundary conditions for your scalar field theory. So instead of studying just pure Dirichlet or pure Neumann, you could do something more interesting. For example, you could say, I want to define a boundary condition for my scalar fields such that the scalar fields at the boundary belong to some manifold in space-time. And then classically, to satisfy the constraints, it's sufficient to require that the normal derivative or the scalar fields should live in the tangent the manifold. Now you can, so you can study this theory quantum mechanically. Try to figure out what's going to happen. And quantum mechanically, that equation will not hold. Now, this boundary condition is still preserves time translations. I mean, translation in one direction. So you still have a conservation law. But the conservation law is sort of weaker than the condition. See, what could happen, for example, is something like that. Some condition like that will still allow you to write down a conservation law. Because if you're integrating on space, your energy density. And you try to see if it's conserved. You can still apply the conservation law. Am I getting myself confused? No. It's fine. So you can rewrite this as and this makes sense. So usually if you don't know no boundary, you just integrate this, you get zero, you get your conservation law. With the boundary, you get this extra term. But if it's actually equal to this, the parallel T, then you can have a conservation law where the energy has a bulk contribution and a boundary contribution. So if there is some energy density which can live at the boundary, then energy can flow in and out. This is just telling you the amount of energy which flows into the boundary equals to the change in the energy density living at the boundary. But if you want to really have diffeomorphism and Weyl invariance, you need this to vanish. So this is like the vanishing of the trace of the stress tensor in the bulk. It's a condition which is needed to have consistent theory of strings propagating with this boundary condition. Another way to think about it is that there is sort of a beta function for this. There is a beta function for the shape of this manifold. The shape of this manifold will change as you change the scale. And so it's so possible to write down an effective action for this, which tells you which boundary conditions are okay. In a sense, gives you equations of motion for the D-brain. So that this manifold in space-time and I pick some local coordinates on the manifold. We call them V1 all the way, V0 all the way to Vd. I can describe this manifold as a sort of an embedding. And there is the effective action. It's what you would naively expect. It's just the square root of the determinant of the induced volume form. So it's just the volume of the D-brain. So we find the number go to action again, but for D-brains instead of for strings. You can even include a metric in space-time. I think it's something like that. So just by studying Bergy flow properties of boundaries, you can find the equations of motion and tell you how the D-brain moves. This is first order in alpha prime, and then there are corrections. Now, we can also include the gauge field. The way you include the gauge field is by adding a term to the action, which is just it's the same coupling you would use to couple a particle to a gauge field. Now you are coupling the endpoint of your string to the gauge field. And so this coupling corresponds to the introduction of this gauge field over there. And then I guess you can also couple the token as usual. The open string token. As a sort of a more boring coupling. So this is just, I didn't have time to go over the state operator map for operators on the boundary, unfortunately. But roughly this object, if we expand it, is the operator which corresponds to the state. And on the other hand, if you really want to make sure to understand why this operator, this state, is what corresponds to movements of the D-brain, you can try to ask yourself what sort of boundary action would you add to a Dirichlet boundary condition to change the Dirichlet boundary condition, to change X naught.
So are we saying that the equations of motion that you wrote down for the brain, they come from, I have some non-vanishing current that you're saying, but what you're saying, imposing Weyl invariance, I get the equations of motion such that Weyl invariance is satisfied.
And so very roughly, for example, you can ask yourself, when is this, even simpler than Weyl invariance, when is that you have scaling invariance?
Okay.
So roughly the current for the scaling transformation is something like X, roughly, is not precise, but is X mu T mu nu. So you can ask, when it is conserved. You can really try to figure out, if this would allow that to be conserved, and you find that it's not. This violation, which is exactly
it. So what I'm asking is, these equations of motion, this action that you wrote down for
yes.
The brain, that comes from constraining your current.
Constraining heat. So this T, for a generic boundary condition, this T is going to be have various terms, and then we'll have something like O mu the power x mu. A. And this O will be the functional, will be the same as the. This O will be the equations of motion for my brain, and will look like del S over del Y mu. I never did this calculation. Actually, haven't seen it in a textbook, but I believe this is the way equations would come out. So check me on this.
You, That said, maybe he would say something more about the opposite signs in that.
Yes. So suppose I have something like that. What sort of source do I get from a Garrigan? So if I do a variation with respect of G, so this couples only to the components of G along the plane. Now, the source for the graviton. So this shows you that the component parallel to the brain, the component perpendicular to the brain, are treated in a bit of a different way. But the stress tensor, suppose that your brain is just flat and extended along space-time, right? So then you get really screwed to the determinant of G mu, but not all the G, 0 to G plus 1, 0 to G plus 1. So when you do a variation to get your stress tensor, it will involve essentially all the components along the brain. Now, the contribution of the state I was writing up there include a contribution something happening to the graviton and to the diaton. So that's why you get both sets of components. I mean, what is, for example, the stress tensor for a particle? Suppose you have a particle coupled to the graviton, to gravity. The stress tensor in space-time is something like that, if I remember correctly, where u is the velocity, is the forward velocity of your particle. For example, a static particle contributes to T0, 0. I think this is correct. Now, I'm not being very precise on how you disentangle the graviton and the dilaton for lack of time. So, see, it's always possible to do a redefinition of coordinates that defines your metric by some power of the dilaton. And this remixes your equations of motions a little bit. So there are various frames, they're called, different choices on which power on how to disentangle the graviton and the dilaton. It's something called the string metric or the Einstein metric. So there is a choice for which the action for the gravity is really that the Einstein action. In different choices, right, the sources between the dilaton and the graviton mix up in different ways. So in one, I guess in the Einstein frame, it must be true that you only get. I'm sorry, I did not do the calculation in detail, so I don't want to say things that are wrong. I have probably already said several things which are incorrect for the last 5 minutes, and it's all recorded. That's life. Any other questions?